several Israeli soldiers have been wounded in a stabbing operation near Ramallah. Meanwhile, regime troops raided several areas near Tubas. There were fresh incursions in Jenin and Nablus as well. In Tukaram, Israeli forces arrested two young men, while in Bethlehem, a woman was injured by Israeli gunfire at a military checkpoint. Israel has launched new strikes in different parts of the Gaza Strip in violation of a ceasefire with Hamas. In the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, a Palestinian has been killed after Israeli forces opened fire there. Al-Burij refugee camp also witnessed fresh attacks in Gaza City's Al-Tufa neighborhood. Israeli drones targeted homes, sparking fires inside residences. Now in southern Gaza, artillery and airstrikes targeted eastern Khan Yunis, with warplanes hitting several areas. Over 350 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire took effect on October 10th, and the overall death toll from U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide since October of 2023 has surpassed 70,100 Palestinians killed. Breaking news before we start this. Another Palestinian journalist has just been killed in the southern city of Khan Yunis. There have been more journalists killed in the Gaza onslaught than any conflict in the past 80 to 100 years throughout the world, over 200 and counting, obviously deliberately targeted by the occupation out of Tel Aviv. The Hamas resistance movement has slammed Israel's restrictions on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza, especially tents and fabricated homes. The Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qassem stressed existing shelters and tents are uninhabitable and cannot withstand harsh winter conditions. He said Israel continues to allow only limited quantities of trucks into Gaza that do not meet even minimum of basic needs of the people amid worsening humanitarian situation throughout the besieged strip. Qassem added that most trucks entering Gaza are designated for commercial sector, and they carry supplementary goods that are not essential for the people. He said Gaza needs the entry of trucks that will carry essential relief materials and in large quantities address the scale of crisis faced by over 2 million people. He said the Gaza truce deal included entry of mobile homes in order to alleviate the suffering of Gazans. Qassem called on mediators and other nations to take urgent and serious action to allow the entry of mobile homes before winter storms hit Gaza. The United Nations marks the annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people on the 29th of November. This year's Day of Solidarity was marked by diplomatic, political, and cultural program at the UN headquarters in Vienna, Austria, on Monday. Our correspondent takes us there.
The UN General Assembly officially established International Solidarity Day in 1977 to express its concern about the continuing plight of the Palestinian people.
Despite the ceasefire, it is still an ongoing genocide. So the special thing is we're trying to bring to the attention of the international community about the plight of the Palestinian people, not only the genocide in Gaza, but also the terror of the settlers in the West Bank.
Speakers stressed that the Palestinian people have not yet achieved their inalienable right as defined by the General Assembly, namely the right to self-determination and national independence, among other things.
The occupation has no moral limits, but during the past 2 years, the Palestinian people have shown their resistance, which made Israel a pariah state. This is what we celebrate on this day. The project for Palestinian nationhood will not come to an end because the Arab states support it.
Representatives and ambassadors from dozens of UN member states expressed their support for Palestine, while many criticized the UN Security Council for its inaction to end the Gaza genocide. On November 17th, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2803, which endorsed US President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan for Gaza.
The document contains several deeply problematic elements. Israel's obligations as an occupying power, including the renunciation of annexation of Palestinian lands and the withdrawal of its forces, are not enshrined. Resolution 2803, adopted by the UN Security Council, does not vest it with the necessary prerogatives to maintain peace and security.
The United Nations Security Council, which would have the powers and the authority to take coercive measures against such extreme violations of international order and international law, has been paralyzed because what is written in its own charter, namely the veto right. In this particular I mean the veto privilege enjoyed by the United States.
The Day of Solidarity at UN concluded with a cultural program featuring the Palestinian choir, Shatat, screenings of Gaza documentaries and Palestinian cuisine.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people at UN headquarters in Vienna concludes a series of events and demonstrations over the past days and weeks. Cultural events, diplomatic meetings and protests were well attended by representatives and people from around the world. However, diplomats from Western states remained largely absent from any shows of solidarity with the Palestinians. Dieter Reinisch from UN headquarters in Vienna.
Israel's brain drain has spiked amid a backlash over judicial overhaul and the war on Gaza. This, according to a study at a university out of Tel Aviv. Research shows a total of about 90,000 Israeli opted for immigration from January of 2023 to September of 2024. They include hundreds of PhDs and medical doctors, as well as thousands of engineers. Rise in immigration coincided with the regime's plans to overhaul the judiciary, which have already sparked mass protests and raising questions about institutional stability. A separate report by Israel Innovation Authority indicates similar findings. Now, according to that report, number of high-tech employees who departed Israeli-occupied territories for long-term relocation increased since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza. Catholic leader Pope Leo has arrived in Lebanon on Sunday for a three-day visit coming from Turkey. Now, Pope says he upholds Catholic Church's desire to foster dialogue inspired by divine love. From Beirut, Mariam Saleh reports.
On the second leg of his first foreign trip as head of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV is in Lebanon for a visit, which he said carries a message of peace.
At times, humanity looks at the Middle East with a sense of trepidation and disheartenment in the face of such complex and long-standing conflicts. Yet in the midst of these struggles, a sense of hopefulness and encouragement can be found when we focus on what unites us, our common humanity, and our belief in a God of love and mercy.
During an interreligious event at Martyrs Square in central Beirut, the Pope listened to representatives from many of Lebanon's 18 officially recognized religious denominations. The Shia cleric asked the Pope to advocate for an end to Lebanon's years-long struggle in the face of Israeli aggression.
We are believers of the significance of the authority of the state, but in its absence, we were forced to defend ourselves and face Israel, which invaded our land. It is not our hobby to take up arms or sacrifice our sons. We therefore put our cause in your hands with what you have of international influence. Perhaps the world can help us out of our crises, primarily the Israeli aggression and its impacts.
Outside the official gatherings, believers await Pope Leo on the main roads to catch a glimpse of the revered figure.
It's a good opportunity to see Pope Leon 14 in our country, and we pray with him for the peace in Lebanon and the Middle East.
The Pope is handling with him a message of peace, a message of love, a message of honor for the country. We are honored to be to him to be with us.
The Pope's recognition of the importance of Lebanon's religious pluralism is considered pivotal, especially at this juncture in time. At the same time, experts believe his visit will most probably not be helpful for Lebanon when it comes to tangible action.
The visit will end within 2 days, and I don't think it will have much impact. We might witness a rise of tension by the Israelis. This is what they have been threatening of. And all we can count on is the capacity of the resistance to word of threats. We cannot, we don't have any other option. No calls for peace, no calls for normalization would have any effect with such a ferocious and criminal enemy such as Israel.
During his visit to Beirut, Pope Leo XIV has prayed for peace in Lebanon and the wider region. However, many fear
that his visit is merely a show of symbolic solidarity, one that will neither halt the Israeli aggression against Lebanon, nor will it end the wave of U.S. intimidation targeting the political leadership. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's foreign minister says the U.S. imposes its will and pursues excessive demands, saying that Washington's approach is a non-starter for any negotiation.
The main problem in relations between Iran and the United States, which currently prevents the start of negotiations, is America's approach based on imposing wills and excessive demands. Unfortunately, we have repeatedly seen this behavior in our interactions with them. If the American side shows readiness for a fair and balanced agreement based on mutual interests, the Islamic Republic of Iran will certainly consider it. We have never left the negotiating table, because diplomacy is an essential part of our approach and principles.
Speaking to an outlet out of Oman, Arashi said that U.S. entered negotiations this year with zero enrichment policy, but Iran, according to Arashi, made it clear from the beginning such a demand is impossible. He insists that no nation can be deprived of its legitimate rights, and regarding regional issues, a top Iranian diplomat said Israel has crossed all red lines by its daily massacres and crimes in the region, as well as attacks on Iran's peaceful nuclear sites in June. Arashi said crimes perpetrated by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has proven to the entire region Israel is the real threat. Answering us now from the southern city of Shiraz in Iran is Ihsan Safanejad, geopolitical analyst. Hello, Mr. Safanejad. Always a pleasure to check in with you. Hope you're doing well down there in Shiraz. Your initial thoughts on, you could take any number of comments made by the Iranian foreign minister and start with there.
Well, the Iranian government, the Iranian diplomatic body, has always shown its readiness to engage with other powers in the world in a diplomatic process. But as the foreign minister of Iran, Mr. Arafji, mentioned, unfortunately, the problem right now, what impedes our efforts to have a fruitful negotiation with the West, is the excessive erroneous and extraneous demands of the United States, which I think was very clear from United States President post on Truth Social when he used all caps, unconditional surrender and three exclamation mark, meaning that they're just not interested in any back and forth in any diplomatic negotiation. A while ago, the Iranian foreign minister also mentioned how Iran was close to reaching some form of a deal, but it was the inability of Steve Witkoff to convince Trump that, we have reached some deal. So all in all, based on our experience, what happened before June 13th attack of Israel and then subsequently the attack of the United States on the Iranian nuclear sites, it has become quite clear that the United States is merely not interested in negotiation. It simply seeks to dictate the articles and the condition that it wants on the on its interlocutor, and this is something that Iran can't really agree with, because Iran actually showed its very powerful capabilities with regards to having second strike capability on its enemy. So Iran is not gonna accept losing without even putting up a fight. And if history is any indication, we have demonstrated that we do actually have means to protect ourselves.
And Ihsan, really quick before we let you go, this policy of excessive demands of, to your point, having zero will to sit down and be flexible at the negotiation table, is this reminiscent of the U.S. approach in general when it comes to negotiations with anyone, or are there exceptions made by the Oval Office when it comes to Iran in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. During four administrations, the administrations of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, President Rouhani, President Raisi, and now President Pezeshkian, Iran has consistently showed that it is willing to go to the to come to the negotiating table and, you know, discuss things in a civil manner. But the problem is that United States diplomatic officials, they are very, very uncivil in their approach. You might remember the 12 conditions of former director of CIA, Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo. And basically, at any iteration, when you look at the conditions that they set to the Iranians for negotiation, it's basically capitulation. And this is something that, as I mentioned, Iran cannot simply accept. So the ball is actually in the United States court, and they have to, if they are actually serious about negotiation, they should stop doing what they do. After the United States attack on Iran, you might remember that the Iranian foreign minister went to Europe and he sought to negotiate with the US side. Same thing happened on the sideline of the United Nations General Assembly. But Mr. Steve Witkoff, interestingly enough, refused to show up. And this mode of behavior, this modus operandi, doesn't work for United States. And Iran will not accept it.
All right. Pleasure to have you on stage today, Mr. Ehsan Safanejad, joining us from my hometown of Shiraz. Meanwhile, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has vowed his country will stand firm against U.S. threats, slamming campaign of psychological terrorism. Maduro is addressing crowds of supporters outside the presidential palace in Caracas. He warned Venezuela will resist any attempt to impose political change by force. Maduro added that his people do not want a slave's peace nor peace of colonies. U.S. President Donald Trump escalated pressure on Caracas with major naval buildup in the Caribbean. The Venezuelan government says buildup and attacks on alleged drug trafficking vessels are part of a broader U.S. effort to topple Maduro and seize control of the country's oil reserves. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. In the name of Allah, dear brother and sister, salam. You're listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, and in this episode, we're going to speak about the impact of social media on human interactions. Today is Tuesday, 11th of Jamadi al-Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, 11th of Azar, 1404 of the Solar calendar, and the 2nd of December, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. For blessing these moments, for blessing our life and our time, this is the Holy Quran which helps us. Chapter Az-Zukhruf, verse 32, has a point. Let's learn.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Ahum yaqsimuna rahmata rabbik. Nahnu qasamna baynahum ma'ishatahum fil hayatid dunya. وَرَفَعْنَا بَعْضَهُمْ فَوْقَ بَعْضٍ دَرَجَاتٍ لِيَتَّخِذَ بَعْضُهُمْ بَعْضًا سُخْرِيًّا وَرَحْمَةُ رَبِّكَ خَيْرٌ مِّمَّا يَجْمَعُونَ
Do they distribute the mercy of your Lord? It is we who have apportioned among them their livelihood in the life of this world, and have raised some of them above others in degrees of rank, that they may make use of one another for service. But the mercy of your Lord is better than whatever they accumulate.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Man is inclined towards social life, and managing differences may solely be carried out through cooperation, and had all people enjoyed the same faculties, opportunities, standards of life, and social status, the principle of cooperation and division of labor would lose their balance. Therefore, they are not supposed to be sneered by such differences and imagine that they are the standards of human values. Worldly possessions and social ranks are of no value against divine mercy and closeness to Allah. The impact of social media on human interactions is the topic of this episode of today's special. I invite you to listen to it. One particularly pernicious concern is whether time spent on social media is eating away at face-to-face time, a phenomenon known as social displacement. As Jeffrey Hall, PhD, says, this issue of displacement has gone on for more than 100 years. He's the director of the Relationships and Technology Lab at the University of Kansas. No matter what the technology is, says Hall, there is always a cultural belief that it's replacing face-to-face time with our close friends and family. In one study, participants kept a daily log of time spent doing 19 different activities during weeks when they were and were not asked to abstain from using social media. In the weeks when people abstained from social media, they spent more time working, cleaning, and doing household chores. However, during these same abstention periods, there was no difference in people's time spent socializing with their strongest social ties.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition from series of today's special from Arab English Radio. This is your host, Alif. As for today, we're going to talk about how does social media affect human interaction. Still under global connectivity, we need to talk about support networks. Online communities and forums offer valuable support networks for individuals facing personal challenges, health issues, or professional dilemmas. These networks provide a space for users to share experiences, seek advice, and find emotional support. The moderation of these networks, often relying on a combination of human oversight and automated content filtering systems, plays a crucial role in maintaining a safe and supportive environment. But as for the challenges to traditional social interaction, we need to actually have a good focus on these changes. Despite its benefits, social media also presents several challenges to traditional forms of social interaction. The shift towards online communication can lead to a decline in face-to-face interactions, potentially impacting the development of essential social skills and emotional intelligence. So, how about the reduced face-to-face interaction? When we face this reduction in face-to-face interaction, we have to be cautious here. Again, excessive reliance on social media can reduce opportunities for in-person interactions, which are crucial for developing nonverbal communication skills, empathy, and emotional regulation. The lack of physical presence can also hinder the formation of deep, meaningful relationships. Studies suggest a correlation between heavy social media use and decreased engagement in offline social activities. Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. Today's special.
Dear brother and sister, you're listening to today's special under the topic of social media do's and don'ts. Don't feel the need to follow the crowd. Ice bucket challenges, smeared makeup selfies, show us your first Facebook picture. The list goes on and on. If you get nominated for something on social media, it's not a binding legal contract. If you don't want to get involved, that's absolutely fine. Do create a positive footprint. Everyone is always banging on about negative behavior online, but so many people use the internet for good. And we like that. Use your time online to get creative. Write a blog. create a video showcase of your talents, or make the world a better place and raise some money for charity. Extra points if you can get adorable kids to help you spread your message. Come here. This is today's special, which speaks about social interactions on social media. It's possible that one of the reasons people continue to use social media is the need to fill a void. But ironically, social media has created a new void in our lives through social comparison. As you disconnect more and more from life, you're going to feel more depressed and directionless. Being involved in social comparison impacts your self-esteem and your self-worth. By continuously engaging in other people's lives through social channels, we begin to compare our behind-the-scenes with their highlights reels, seeing only a filtered glimpse of their world and not the entire raw footage. Therefore, when we compare every aspect of ourselves, from relationships to body image, we feel more depressed and dip further into a false reality.
As for these interactions, what the impact on social skills and emotional intelligence? The shift towards online communication can have a significant impact on the development of social skills and emotional intelligence. The absence of nonverbal cues in online interactions can lead to misunderstanding and misinterpretations, while the emphasis on brevity and consciousness can hinder the development of effective communication skills. And what should we do for the decline in nonverbal communication skills? This is again another issue that we have to be a little bit sensitive and cautious about. Face-to-face interactions rely heavily on nonverbal cues such as body language, facial expressions, and tone of voice. These cues provide valuable information about the speaker's emotions, intentions, and attitudes. The absence of these cues in online interactions can make it difficult to accurately interpret messages and build rapport.
That was a very essential and interesting topic. So inshallah, we'll continue during these days. Tomorrow, be with us with the same topic. Thank you for listening. That was today's special from IRIB English Radio. And till then, fi amanillah.
So far from Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi. In this show, we delve into the forces of war, imperialism, and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. I'm delighted to be joined today by investigative journalist and author Matt Kennard. Matt is the co-author of Silent Coup, How Corporations Overthrew Democracy, and the author of two other acclaimed books. He used to be a staff writer at the Financial Times in New York, Washington, D.C., and London. He then served as a fellow and later director of the Center for Investigative Journalism in London, and he co-founded Declassified UK. He is now an independent journalist. Thank you very much for joining me today, Matt. I want to go straight into talking with you about Britain's active involvement, not just complicity, in the genocide that's being perpetrated in Gaza. In January 2024, you broke a story about how Britain had conducted 50 spy flights over Gaza in support of Israel. That number is now over 500. And you've continued to cover that issue, which until recently was totally not just ignored, but I would say covered up by the mainstream media. Before we get into how and why that mission has come to an end, could you give us a recap about what these spy flights are and what they were all about?
Yeah, well, as you say, these spy flights are the key component of UK support for Israel's genocide, which makes it active participation rather than complicity. Because, and this is not just me saying this, this is legal experts, if you are providing intelligence from over a territory being attacked by a genocidal power, you are a party to that conflict, and you're giving intelligence, which to this day we still don't know what that intelligence is, and we don't know what departments of the Israeli state they're providing it to. But these flights were announced in December 2023 by the Tory administration at that point. And it was just a government press release, and they did not say where they were going from, how long they were going to be in the sky, what plane would be used, or anything about it. And so I started looking on flight tracking websites and found where the plane was going from, which was RAF at Akrotiri on Cyprus, which I'd been working on up to that point anyway, because that's the key international site for all the international support for Israel in terms of arms supplies, spies being sent, logistic support since the genocide started and continues now. But anyway, so I started seeing these flights go, saw that they were Shadow R1 planes, which are intelligence, reconnaissance and surveillance planes, which can really get granular detail on the ground. And one of their main capabilities is target acquisition for military strikes. I saw they were going every day as well, and they've basically gone every day up till about a week ago. And they're in the sky for 6 hours. One of those hours is getting to and from Gaza from RAF Akrotiri on Cyprus. 5 hours over Gaza, just collecting intelligence. Now, we never knew what their flight path was over Gaza, because what happened was about halfway to Gaza, they turned the transponder off. Then on the way back, they turned the transponder back on. So there's massive amounts of secrecy around it, and also not just around the flights themselves, but around what intelligence is being collected and how it's being used by Israel. Because when they've had to defend it, the government, which is very little, because as you say, the mainstream media barely covered it. In fact, they haven't covered it at all, really. But when they've had to defend it, when they've been asked questions in Parliament by MPs, who have, some of them have been quite dogged, all they say is, well, it's all to do with hostage rescue. and we only give intelligence to the relevant authorities. They never say what those relevant authorities are. But think about it. That's semantic wordplay. Israel characterizes their whole genocide as a hostage rescue operation. The relevant authorities for hostage rescue must be the occupation forces and their intelligence agencies, because they're the one leading the campaign. So I think we need much more will come out over the coming years. And hopefully, and this is why I believe that the ICC and the ICJ need to get involved, because the process of legal discovery would mean that we could get a lot of information that we can't as journalists, because we're talking about institutions and agencies within the UK state, which are the most secret parts of the UK state, the intelligence agencies, and they're not secret to defend us. Maybe there's a little bit of secrecy they need for their operations, but 95% of it is to defend themselves from us. All this stuff has been got from open source. There's been no actual whistleblower from within the program. So if you started scratching the surface, I'm sure it would completely unravel, and you'd find out that we have been for nearly 2 years just active participants in a very direct way. So it's hugely important. I mean, this is, and it goes to what you were saying about the media. I sometimes can't understand how it's just, and a few other journalists, but it's basically been me covering this story. There's no more serious crime than genocide that a state can commit. And when you're talking about our government actively participating in it, this should be like every journalist in the country that's covering this stuff should be going any avenue they can to get the information, and there's been nothing. And I think it goes to the heart of what the media in this country is for. We don't have a media in the sense of how it's commonly understood. What we have is a propaganda system. And Gaza has exposed that, I think, like never before. Gaza has exposed many, many different myths that we live by in this country and globally. But one of the biggest ones is that we have this crusading free press, fourth estate, which holds power to account. We don't at all. It operates 99% of the time as an arm of the state itself. And the other 1%, when they're actually doing critical stories, they're always surface scandals. They're nothing that tells you anything about the systematic workings of the British state. And definitely don't tell you anything about the secretive agencies, which have a lot of power in this country and basically never covered. So, it's been a pretty eye-opening experience covering this stuff. And also, the other thing which I should mention is Spyfire is only one component. And there's obviously the arms that have been going. 150,000 bullets were sent to Israel soon after October 7th, when the genocide started. They've been sending armored tanks, all sorts of different military equipment. They also have sent parts for the F-35 plane, which became controversial recently because they, when Labour announced a partial suspension of arms to Israel in September 2024, they carved out the parts for the F-35 jet, which 15% of which is produced in the UK, which is absurd. Because how can you say, well, our lawyers have said that any weapons that go to Israel that can be used in Gaza run the risk of being used in violations of international humanitarian law, and leave out the part, which is the parts for the main bit of technology which is carrying out that genocide? It doesn't make any sense on the legal terms. And in fact, there was a recent case which was lost insanely by two human rights groups to try and get the government to stop the F-35 parts. Anyway, then there's also the SAS, which again is not talked about at all. In fact, there was the only mention of the SAS in Gaza was in the mainstream media on October 27th. There was an article in The Sun, and this is how the SAS work. They're not against leaks, but they only do official leaks, and always there to present the SAS as this heroic institution. So in October 27th, 2023, there was an article in The Sun, which was based on sources saying that the SAS had deployed to Cyprus for Gaza operations. Heroic hostage rescue operations. Following day, a D notice was sent out by the Ministry of Defence to all media to say you can't publish anything more about UK Special Forces in Gaza. To this day, there's not been a single bit of information which has come out in the media about what those Special Forces have been doing. I actually recently published that D notice because I got hold of it. Again, it goes back to the media point. I mean, and means they're complicit. If they have received information about our special forces being involved in Israel or on the ground in Gaza, it's not preposterous to think that could have happened. And they've not published it because they've been told by the Ministry of Defence that there's a D notice. They're complicit because the D notice is officially voluntary. So there's not even any punitive I mean, there might be sort of like unofficial punitive measures that can be taken against newspapers, but the fact that we've had no more information, the fact that they kept that D-notice secret, all that the D-notice I published for the first time had gone to every single media editor in the UK, and not one thought it would be the right moral thing to publicise it. The only way we knew about its existence was a Socialist Worker wrote a story about it. They didn't publish the D-notice itself, but that was a big service in itself. But so it's deep, deep complicity. I don't think you can think of the Gaza genocide as just an Israeli genocide. It's and I say this all the time, so I'm sure people are bored of hearing it, but it is a tripartite genocide. It's the US, it's the UK, and it's Israel. Now, the US providing the vast majority of the arms, also special forces, by the way. It was reported early in the genocide that US special forces had been deployed to Israel. Britain providing the majority of the intelligence, it seems, or that's their role, and Israel getting it done because, and I'll finish with this, just on the spy flights where we started, subsequent to the work we were doing, there was an investigation by Al Jazeera into reconnaissance flights over Gaza. This came out last year, 2024. And they found that 47% of all reconnaissance flights over Gaza were flown by the RAF, which was more than double Israel itself. So how are you not a party to a conflict if that's the stats that have been gathered from open source intelligence? And the UK government admits they're giving that intelligence to Israel. They don't say what departments or what it's for, what apart from hostage rescue. But to me, there's no confusion. If we lived in a world which actually applied international law, UK ministers would be getting arrest warrants from the ICC now. And again, I should. We talk a lot about Starmer and Lammy and John Healey, who's the defence secretary. But this also goes for the previous Conservative administration. Who started the spy flights themselves. So Rishi Sunak, Grant Shapps, who was Defence Secretary, David Cameron, who was Foreign Secretary. So there's a whole coterie of war criminals that have served in the UK government and been complicit in, and participants, in fact, in one of the worst crimes in modern history, maybe of all history. So it's going to take years of work to unravel the reality of what's happening, because, as I say, what we know now is the result of independent journalists using mostly open source stuff. So as soon as over the years, when we get more whistleblowers, when we get more information, hopefully from legal cases and other avenues, we'll get a much more full understanding. And that's why I always say, like, this won't stop when the genocide finishes. This is a years of work that we're all going to be dedicated to, because we have to hold the people that are accountable for this to justice, because if we don't, then we just accept that we live in a genocidal world and the law of the jungle rules, and we can't accept that. So it's imperative to stop it happening again, but also just to stop the complete disintegration of our society, that we hold accountable the people that did this. And obviously, we have some hope in the ICC arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, because although they took too long, that's the first time Western leaders have been... and our allies have been prosecuted, despite us being the most violent and war criminal countries in the world. So the fact that that threshold was crossed means that the idea that our own prime minister or the US president, or on behalf of the US president, because they're not part of the ICC, but, you know, the people that we assume, and people would be shocked if you said they're going to be in the restaurant, we need to change that idea, and we need to understand that the ICC was essentially created as an imperial tool, and it was created to go after official enemies, which is what it did up to the Gaza genocide.
I agree completely on that. And of course, we praise you for the work that you've done in exposing all of this. I think because of your doggedness in pursuing the government on these sorts of matters, you were even blacklisted at one point by the UK Ministry of Defence.
Yeah, that was earlier on at Declassified. That was actually a very salutary tale of how the media system worked. That happened like about a year into us founding Declassified. And I did a story basically about how MI5 and MI6 were training spies from some of the worst dictatorships in the world, like the Saudis, the Egyptians, the UAE, you know, at a base called Chicksands just outside London. And like always, I contacted the MOD for comment, because it was an MOD course that they were training them on. and they just didn't respond. And then I called them and they said, we'll get back to you, and they didn't respond. So I was very, like, sort of like, they never do this. This is the first time this has happened. And then a couple of weeks later, there was a protest by Ahmed Al-Batati. I don't know if you remember him. Yes. He was a Yemeni soldier. Oh, sorry, a British soldier, but a British Yemeni, who was serving in the Ministry of Defense and went out in his fatigues outside the Ministry of Defense and blew a whistle every minute to symbolize how many Yemenis were dying because of the British war in Yemen, which it was a British war. It wasn't just a Saudi war. He got arrested by military police and then discharged. But anyway, when he was taken in, Phil Miller, my colleague, contacted the Ministry of Defense for comment about what had happened to him, what the process was, and they didn't get back to him. And then he called them again, and he was recording the call, and the officer and the press officer said, oh, we don't deal with your publication anymore. Which is a contravention of the civil service code, by the way, because you're meant to, you have to interact with all journalists despite their political affiliations or style of journalism. And then they probably thought, well, this is a small website, nothing's going to happen. But it escalated, and a Council of Europe media alert was sent out, level two, which is quite a big deal, and also means, because the Council of Europe, the UK's part of, meant that the Ministry of Defence had to respond. So anyway, Ben Wallace, who was then Defence Secretary, ordered a inquiry, which was carried out by Tony Blair's former spokesperson, not Alistair Campbell, another one. And he published a report which showed essentially that we'd been blacklisted, but yet Ben Wallace still didn't accept that there was a blacklisting in his place. He said it appeared to many people in the PRIF office that it was a blacklisting. It was just like legalese. But the interesting thing was he that whole report, which was quite shocking, by the way, it was like anonymous military officers said, we need to put them on a list of hostile media organizations. You don't know what that means within the context. So they published that report, which was a long report, very, very shocking and worrying for the free press. Then Wallace gets up in the House of Commons, apologizes to Declassified UK, which is kind of unprecedented. And still to this day, not a single word about it has ever appeared in the mainstream media, which is crazy. Because when you talk about that level of response, like you would imagine, and the Council of Europe, you expect that the mainstream media, who you would think would defend fellow journalists who are actually doing proper work, unlike them, they didn't. But that was, again, it goes to show that the Ministry of Defence just did not know how to deal with journalists who, I mean, and they still are, don't take any state or corporate funding, completely independent, not working for any hostile powers or anything. But they just couldn't accept journalists, or didn't understand journalists that were asking questions in a critical way to try and find out information that the government didn't want out. Like, literally, if you look at the main defence correspondents from, like, Jonathan Beale at the BBC, Deborah Haynes at Sky News, nearly everything they publish is just a reworded MOD press release. It's shocking. Well,
Jonathan Beale recently decried the reporting on these spy flights. I think he attacked Des Friedman and also maybe John McAvoy at Declassified for reporting on it. And he asked, I'm paraphrasing, whether they had access to some secretive, privileged information. And it's like, well, this is all publicly sourced. If you're doing your job, you'd have also discovered this.
It's a mindset. That's the interesting thing. That's my take on a propaganda system. It's not that he is being controlled. It's just that he has not ever got in his head an idea that he wants to find out information that the government doesn't want out. Because he's so immersed in that mainstream media world, especially at the BBC, where you're just an appendage of the state, that the thought to actually maybe do a bit of independent research never crosses his mind. It's that Noam Chomsky interview with Andrew Marr, you know, when Andrew Marr says, do you believe I don't think what I say? And he said, no, you think what you say, but you wouldn't be where you are if you thought any different. So anyone who does critical journalism gets filtered out way before they get to the level of Jonathan Beale. And that's the way it works. And that's why it's quite funny when they respond like that, because they're not aware of it. They always say, well, I can write what I want and I can do what I want. It's like, well, that's because you never say anything that the state doesn't like. If you did, you'd soon find out that they wouldn't allow you to continue. But but as you say, I mean, you said active participants. I'd say they're complicit, definitely, because if you, like, to go back to the F-35 September 2024 suspensions by Labour, right? That only happened because when the media has focused on UK role, it's always on arms, which is good. Like, obviously, I think there should be a complete arms embargo. There should have been one a long time ago. But the government was pressured by that media pressure and mainstream media pressure. If the mainstream media had borne that pressure on the spy flights, they would have been grounded a year ago or more.
Well, also, just speaking of complicity, you recently broke a story about numerous Israeli jets of an active in perpetrating the Gaza genocide have been landing in Britain.
Yeah, mad. Not picked up at all by the mainstream media, as it never is. But yeah, is active participation, because these are Israeli tankers. They're called Reem air-to-air refueling planes. Yeah, they landed at Bryce Norton 9 times at least. That's what we could find. I'm sure there's more. But they landed at RF Bryce Norton all under the Labour government. And then days later, on some occasions, they were flying off Gaza refueling fighter jets when there were massacres of nearly 100 people in one in Beit Lahia. And it just got, and then recently, the head of the Israeli Air Force came and attended the air tattoo at a UK military base. This is a guy that is basically the architect of, in terms of the air war, of the genocide. And he's been welcomed by the Labour government. It is astounding, the level of complicity and participation. And it goes to the fact that I think that effectively we are occupied by the Israeli state in many ways through different mechanisms. One is the official Israel lobby, like the Israeli embassy and its various different agencies, but also through the groups they have within our political system, like Labour Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, which are front groups for the embassy, both of whom don't reveal their funders. But you know, in that Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby, Michael Rubin, who was then the parliamentary officer for the LFI, was recorded outside a pub saying, well, we work closely with the embassy and they send us things to say when there's trouble for Israel. So effectively, every statement you see posted by LFI is probably drafted by the Israeli embassy, highly likely. That's one section. Then there's the other section, which is nominally Jewish groups that are meant to represent Jewish interests or Jewish communal interests that have been infiltrated by the Israeli embassy and the Zionist movement and made to work, like the Jewish labor movement. There's not hard evidence of links to the embassy, although Ella Rose was at the Israeli embassy and then became head of Jewish labor movement, I think. But it's clear from their statements that they're basically operating as an Israel lobby group. The same with the
Even in the Jewish labor movement constitution, they're bound to support Israel.
Exactly. Yeah. And